Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's that most wonderful time of the year, Ask Me Another's Holiday Spectacular. The show's stuffed tighter than a Christmas turkey with holiday food trivia, Christmas song parodies, and all your favorite reindeer word games. Plus, the composers of Disney's Frozen try their hand at a Mariah Carey holiday classic. You know the one. Get in the holiday spirit by listening to Ask Me Another on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we'll talk about Chris Rock's new film, Top 5, which combines elements of comedy and romance and biting industry satire. Then we'll celebrate a great NPR music project and talk about the art of the mixtape. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us this week is Audie Cornish. Audie Cornish, what do you do at NPR?
I am a co-host at All Things Considered.
And in that capacity, you interviewed Chris Rock.
I did. That's actually the reason why I do that job.
to talk to Chris Rock.
It's all been leading up to this.
It felt like it.
Yeah.
It really felt like it for me because he's like right in my wheelhouse in terms of my age group and the comedian of my generation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, definitely.
I saw not just the interview that was on All Things Considered, but also the long clip of the two of you talking about rappers.
Me and Chrissy just chilling.
Talking about your top five.
Hip-hop artists we like. And Chris Rock.
Right,
sure.
which comes up in the movie, but also the two of you agreeing that it was LL Cool J, right? Was the Six Man,
yeah. Rakim, we had overlap with Rakim, mm-hmm. which was nice.
That's a good conversation. We'll link to that.
Yeah.
That was fun. So we all saw Top 5. In the movie, Chris Rock plays a guy who is a comic actor, has done these movies where he has kind of a catchphrase character in comedies, a bear who is a cop. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of Martin Lawrence doing Big Mama's House, Eddie Murphy as the donkey in Shrek.
Lethal Weapon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a combination of those roles.
The movie catches him on the day when he is promoting his first serious role, which is in a movie about a Haitian slave uprising, right?
It's called Uprise, spelled with a Z.
I don't know.
It's like cackled when I saw that.
And on this day, as he's doing the promotion, he's also being interviewed by a New York Times reporter played by Rosario Dawson. And so they walk around the city and they go visit his family and they visit her apartment and they have a bunch of conversations, which I think are the best part of the movie. Then eventually it sort of turns into something I did not think was as interesting. But along the way, there's a lot of stuff about the industry. And how did the movie strike you, Audie?
I've seen his other movies like Good Hair, which was a documentary. And also,
that's a great movie.
Yeah, I think I Love My Wife. And even the Neil LaBute comedy, The Funeral? Deep cuts. Okay.
Yes.
And what struck me about it is in all of those movies, the reviews are always like, what is this, Chris Rock? Like, we just don't understand what to do with you. And there's something he actually said in a New Yorker profile that came out a while back where he said, I needed to kind of figure out what a Chris Rock movie was. Mm-hmm. He was on the set of Grown Ups 2, and that's Adam Sandler movie.
He was like,
it's not this.
Well, no, not that. In fairness, what he said is like Adam Sandler, like you can say an Adam Sandler movie, and that's a meaningful term to people. That's a shorthand for something, whatever you think that is.
It
and Chris Rock, I guess, felt like, what's mine? And he sat down and wrote himself something. And this is the first film I've seen him in where I thought he looked comfortable in his own skin. You know, anything, of course, serious at all has always felt vaguely uncomfortable for him and for the audience.
Yeah, I think that's right.
He's come a long way since Dogma, Kevin Smith's Dogma, which is the first thing I saw him in that wasn't sketch and wasn't stand-up.
Yeah.
Where he was, in his defense, he was very stiff in that film. But in his defense, he was saddled with some mid-period Kevin Smith dialogue, which has overmatched better actors than he is. And here, some of that stiffness is still there.
I agree.
But he's much better. I mean, if you doubt that there's any stiffness there, you just have to see him on the same screen as Rosaria Dawson taking the same dialogue, pinging back and forth, and just seeing what she's doing with it and what he's doing with it.
Yeah.
It felt to me like a promising first film, which it isn't. It isn't his first film.
But in a way it is, because the other films are like kind of takeoffs of
exactly,
other things.
Exactly. Right. I Think I Love My Wife is basically an adaptation of the Eric Rohmer film, Chloe in the Afternoon.
Yeah.
And it felt like there are a lot of ideas here, very disjointed, all kind of crammed together without themes really developing, or at least themes being asserted but not really felt.
Yeah, my feeling on this movie was, especially in the beginning, it was about as close as I've seen to the platonic ideal of a Chris Rock movie, which is, namely, I want to watch Chris Rock talk.
Sure.
I want to listen to Chris Rock talk. Linda, in her review of the film, links to a couple of fantastic, one is an interview and one is an essay. Mm-hmm. He wrote this essay in The Hollywood Reporter, and he did an interview with Frank Rich in Vulture. And if those were converted into a movie, I would be thrilled. I would just sit there with my popcorn, just delighted.
And there's a lot of that in Good Hair.
Right.
That's a lot of what that movie has in it, is him talking to people.
In this mix of truth-telling and humor just springing out of unexpected places, because he's just funny. Mm-hmm. And anything that feels like it is coming directly, undiluted, from his brain to the screen and just his thoughts to the screen, I really loved. And the more conventional parts of it didn't work as much for me.
The stuff at the beginning where he's grappling with all the business about being a comic actor who's trying to make this dramatic movie, which in the film looks terrible. You know, I mean, he's trying to figure out this idea about what people expect of you versus what you want to do and what your aspirations are. And there's a good tension about, is this a guy who's legitimately being underestimated, or mm-hmm. is this a guy whose reach exceeds his grasp mm-hmm. a bit in terms of what kind of acting he wants to do?
And I love the fact that that movie looks terrible. I think that's a very clever conceit in the film, is it's not like he's got this brilliant film in him and he's misunderstood.
And it's just not clear how much of it is the one and how much of it is the other. But then, no, because he's walking around New York all day with this beautiful New York Times reporter who's profiling him, it's kind of inevitable that you get this question of, like, is it going to turn into a romance? And
is it really a question?
Well,
when you see everyone's favorite New York girlfriend come on screen in full side hawk.
Yep.
And when you see, you know, so the closer it gets to going down that road and being that story, the less I cared about it and the less convincing I thought it was, because it does all take place in one day. So when you're trying to build up some serious story between the two of them, and it winds up invariably, you have some really, to me, kind of dumb twists, including, I'm sorry, a thing that would never happen at the New York Times. a sort of an assertion about her job and a couple of things about the way she does her job. There is no way. And so it feels like a fake creation of conflict. And so the more they got into that, the less I was into it. We should point out, there are a lot of other really good people in this movie. J.B. Smoove is in this movie. I thought Gabrielle Union was very funny in this movie, playing a Real Housewife on a Bravo reality show. I thought she was very funny. And then there's all these people, like Tracy Morgan's in it. Ben Vereen pops up in it. Sherry Shepherd, Romy Malco. Just tons and tons of people kind of popping up all over the place.
And remarkable, like, past and present, upwards of 4 SNL cast members who are black. What?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I almost stood up and clapped. It's just true. Like slow clap. Like, gotta love this.
Exactly.
Jay Farrow and
Michael Che's
yeah,
in it.
Exactly.
And
Leslie Jones.
And I think those scenes are lovely. I think there are several scenes where he is interacting with a group of people, and you have what you sense is the easy banter of those people in real life, and it feels very naturalistic. I think the stuff about journalism, Chris Rock understands journalism like Woody Allen understands poor people. You watch a Woody Allen movie where he's like depicting a working class family.
Yep.
Like, that's kind of the level of Chris Rock's understanding of how the New York Times would
but
work.
Celebrity, on the other hand, I think.
Celebrity,
I mean,
the
family stuff is good, but I also like the celebrity stuff. I like the part where that scene that he does with Brian Regan playing the kind of...
He's like a Sirius XM.
He's like a Sirius XM engineer, and he's hyping him up to try to make wacky station promos. By the way, if you've never listened to any Brian Regan stand-up, it is A, clean, and B, so, so incredibly good. He's hilarious. And in this movie, he's just there for like a minute.
Yep.
Just being a goof.
Hey, what's up? This is Andre Allen. And when I listen to satellite radio, I listen to Sirius Hits 1.
Just, you know, say, just put a little stank on it.
Stank.
Stank. Stank.
Stank?
Give it stank.
Okay, I don't really know what you mean. Could you show me?
You're the funny, okay, all right, it's like, hey, this is Andre Allen, and when I listen to satellite radio, whoa, I listen to Sirius Hits 1, woo!
Stank.
Stank. Nice and funny. Go.
What's up?
And that kind of stuff, the stuff about what it's like to be in that just sausage-making machine of movie promotion, yeah. I really liked.
That makes sense because when we, in the interview, this didn't make the cut, but he did say essentially, like, I wanted to make a movie about comedians and, like, in our lives as comedians. And that's where he's most at home in the film, is when he's kind of just shooting things with his friends.
Everybody
you know?
Does the best satire about the things they actually understand. Yeah. I mean, we would all make a better satire of public radio than we would
I do.
Satire
and
of television.
And I also want to invoke some sort of rule about judging a movie by its depiction of female journalists, because I give up. I have decided in Hollywood, because all of them, because they only experience journalism from a paparazzi or tabloid standpoint, they have zero clue about what you're doing every day. And every time I see a woman on screen with a notebook or a tape recorder,
something
bad's
gonna
happen. It's just a countdown until she's going to sleep with the guy. Serious movies, not so serious movies. If I had as much sex as portrayed in the movies.
I don't know. You'd be a very busy girl.
I'd be a very busy girl.
No, it's true.
It's a wrap.
It's all right. True.
Well, speaking of the sex, okay, so I have this theory that there are in the world poop and fart joke people and sex joke people.
Yeah.
And they very rarely overlap. I have friends who think poop and fart jokes are hilarious and get very uncomfortable when you bring up the topic of sex. I personally love a really filthy, perverted sex joke, but the poop and fart jokes just disgust me. I can't handle it. I actually become nauseated. This film has some pretty raunchy stuff in it, but there is this thin thread of, and I don't want to call it homophobia because you use that word, people go into a defensive crouch.
Right.
Let's call it gay panic. It's more localized than that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's unique to Chris Rock, and it's certainly, and I disagree with some of my friends in the gay community here, I don't think it's in any way unique to black comedians.
Yeah.
It is endemic to comedy, and it turns up in some of the weirdest places, even in what used to be called the alternative comedy scene.
Right.
These are people who pride themselves on their progressiveness and the fact that they challenge the status quo. Comedy is comedy, and when something dies, a bit dies, and there's this audience out there, and they know that by hitting the gay panic button, they can get a laugh, they go for it.
Right.
And it's just, it's still is surprising to me. And my reaction to it, whenever I see it happen, and I see it happen a lot, if you are a comedy nerd like I am and you're gay like I am, you see it happen a lot, my reaction is never outrage. I'm not going to be the one writing the, you know, humorless scold think piece. There might be some out there. My reaction is always, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely.
It's like, you could have been funnier. You could have been sharper. You could have been more specific. You could have been more pointed. But you're not challenging anything. You're asserting something. Any comedian is only as progressive as their audience is. By asserting something that's like, yeah, see, isn't gay sex ooky? Or isn't anything about two dudes?
Weird and more embarrassing than other sex things happening to you in public, or more embarrassing and more upsetting and humiliating than other situations in which something happens with your boyfriend.
And that certain sex acts are inherently gay.
Right,
exactly.
So comedians who insist that this is just, you know, you're being PC and funny is funny and comedy should be able to challenge anything and be an equal opportunity offender, sure, but there's laughter and there's laughter. And it all gets complicated by the fact that unlike other art forms, laughter is the metric for comedy.
Right.
And there's no clear metric for, you know, paintings or even music. It's not that clear. But there's smart laughter and there's stupid laughter. And there's pandering and there's kind of challenging what your audience is doing. And so...
Well, yeah, and there's laughter that you get because people are having an interesting friction of your idea up against their brain.
Right.
And there's laughter that you get because you're telling people a thing that they think, but you're telling them that thing really loudly.
Exactly.
And I think that a lot of times these jokes about, like, it's more humiliating, for example, if your boyfriend turns out to be gay than if your boyfriend leaves you for another woman, mm-hmm. right? That's inherently more hilarious, mm-hmm. right? That it's more of a kind of giant story of how embarrassing and how unbelievably terrible. And
how irrevocable.
And how irrevocable, right? Mm-hmm. The humor that comes in those things is reinforcing humor. It's
right.
humor where everybody is putting their arm around you and saying, like, isn't this just the case? And lots of comedy is like that.
Absolutely.
Lots of comedy is inclusive like that, where you're putting your arm around people and you're saying, don't we all get this? And don't we all get why this is? But there's a difference between that and the actually irreverent comedy of people being exposed to an uncomfortable idea,
right.
which is not the same thing.
So when we talk about this, if comedy is going to be taken as an art form, which I firmly believe it is, it has to be able to be criticized. You can't just say your reaction as an audience is either to laugh or shut up. And that's the only thing you can do.
Yeah.
It has to be able to be criticized. And so let's go back to this particular film. The two big raunchy set pieces of this film have a sensibility of gay panic in them. And one weird out of left field plot turn comes straight out of a Madea movie. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. this weird thing that ties into nothing else in the film. It's
yeah.
just there to be funny. So again, I like this film. I thought it was funny. Every interview I've read with him, what I like about him is that he's incredibly practical. He's asked in the Bullseye interview with Jesse Thorne, he's asked, why are you still doing stand-up? And he says, well, I like it, and I make good money.
Yeah.
Nothing about the craft, nothing about my art, nothing about, I am a clown, you know, nothing.
Well, you know that some of that same stuff is there. When he says, I like it, some of
sure.
that same stuff is there.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm sort of so-so on this movie. I like certain things about mm-hmm. it. I don't like other things about it. The irony is, in a movie that's about how terrible it is to promote a movie, the sort of tour of interviews that
junket,
he did,
yeah.
the junket that he's done, the kind of whistle-stop tour of media outlets, and he's done a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has done
yeah,
a lot.
You could get him at your bar mitzvah. I firmly believe Chris Rock is available right now.
Well, and there was a great, in that piece that he did with Frank Rich for New York Magazine, I believe it is, he has a line in there where he says, I don't do publicity except when I'm promoting a movie. He doesn't just go out and talk about his life. But then when he's got a movie to promote, he does lots of stuff. It's
right.
not, I'm going to pick one thing and be very, you know, hard to get. You know, I mean, just on NPR, he was on ATC.
Yeah.
He was on Fresh Air. He did Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, which we distribute in. And that's just public radio. You
right.
know what I mean? And there's probably a bunch of other stuff. He may have done stuff with stations. Like, he did a lot, you know. So in some ways, the best thing to come out of this movie about hating promoting movies is the stuff
at
he did.
At a certain point, I wondered if it was a kind of performance art.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, if he was just having a meta conversation about it. I remember at one point in our conversation, he said, when we were just like chatting about something, and he goes, see, we're having a real conversation. And like, he had just come off of like two of the morning shows, the big TV morning shows. And I assumed he'd be like tired. But when you talk to these people on junkets, you feel like you're abusing them. They're exhausted. You know what I mean? They've answered the same questions hundreds of times, and they are totally clear that that's what they're doing.
And that scene is in this movie.
Yeah.
And I liked it. You know?
But he hasn't been doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
People are literally, it's like playing fetch with him. People are like, what about this? What about that? Ferguson, give your thoughts on that. I mean, people are asking him whatever they want. Now they're just clearly running out of things.
Yeah.
But because he's so smart and quick on his feet,
yeah.
he just gives an answer. You know, he's always got something. I felt like, yeah, I want to really talk to people. If I'm going to do this, I'm going
right.
to enjoy myself and say things that are meaningful.
Well, I don't know how many of you have seen Top 5, but if you have, if you haven't, if you're curious about it, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you think. Now, our other topic today, I feel like I should call upon Stephen Thompson to introduce it a little bit and talk about the NPR Music Project that got us talking about this.
It's December, and December is always a time of of fighting at NPR Music, and then it is a time of coming together and publishing our year-end best ofs. You know, we do the 50 albums, and usually we do 100 songs. And there's just as big a knockdown drag-out over the 100 songs, because we're not only picking 100 songs with, you know, the tastes of 20 different people, but it's also, we try to be as genre-diverse as possible. So you've got classical songs up against jazz songs, up against hip-hop songs, up against pop songs. And so Jacob Gans, who is the incredibly patient man who was in charge of that process, decided this year, instead of narrowing it down to 100, he created a Songs We Love mixtape that is 302 songs long. Jacob, you know, led up this project, and part of its charm is this visual of, you know, Songs We Love hand-scrawled on a big old cassette. And so we started talking about mixtapes, which I write an advice column for NPR Music called The Good Listener. I've written about mixtapes, I've done six columns about mixtapes. So mixtapes, do they still have relevance in the age of Spotify, etc.?
Audie Cornish, thoughts?
The answer is yes, but as with the voicemail, it's starting to feel like a losing battle. I will say, for people like me who hate feelings and emotion, public displays of emotion.
Sure, yes,
you know,
go
people,
on.
For people, if you have to, you know, for people who people ask you permission to hug you, It is really great to be able to send a song. And I still do that all the time. I text people, you told me about your breakup last week, and here's a song I thought
aww
really fit it. And yeah, they always feel that way, I think, because of the no hugging rule. But
yeah, the boy
hugged me, Audie Cornish.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a crowd out there.
That's so, true.
She was actually using you as a shield.
Exactly. Exactly. No, anyway, so I still feel like songs obviously convey a lot of emotion, and I still like sharing them. And it's not the same as a mixtape, but I've definitely sent someone an email with 5 songs that I'm like, this is the thing for whatever reason I'm sending to you. And it has its own appeal because you can see the titles of the songs, and maybe you go to a lyric video, or there's some aspects of it actually that I think have carried over that are not the same as, you know, kind of wearing out the tape, the cassette tape.
So you're saying that they kind of they do some of the heavy lifting of moving the ball down the field romantically or emotionally?
A little bit.
They do some of your hard work for you.
A little bit, because you can see the list of titles and the sequence that they're in. Even if the person hits shuffle, when they first see your mix, they see this lovely little listing. Mm. And if you do a good job, shuffle will still work. Okay. Mm. That's my argument. Mm. So I don't think the mixtape is totally over, but I do think that if anyone uses this app, or you're a cord cutter, or someone who has a computer in your living room, what comes up on your screen will be a giant cassette tape.
That's true.
And it's totally cool.
It is.
It's a little weird because you can click on it and suddenly there's my face.
Oh boy.
There are other faces for people who are deterred by that.
Didn't know about that. There are rules to the making of mixtapes. I'm not asserting this.
Everybody obviously just leans back in their chair.
Yeah. But I do have a little something from somebody who asserts some of those rules.
The making of a great compilation tape, like breaking up, is hard to do and takes ages longer than it might seem. You got to kick it off with a killer to grab attention. Then you got to take it up a notch. But you don't want to blow your wad, so then you got to cool it off a notch. There are a lot of rules.
That is Rob Gordon, played by John Cusack in the film High Fidelity.
In
the book, he's named Rob Fleming. And the book, more than the movie, spends a lot of time on the logistics of the mixtape.
Yeah.
and what it's about and what it's for. And, of course, it's about mixtape, so it's not about shuffle.
Right.
The whole point is we don't shuffle. It's about...
I try not to be like this, but I'm like this about the shuffling of the mixes.
All right. It's all right.
Now, I've made a few mixtapes and mix CDs in my time. Not for other people, for me. I just want to listen to them. And I've actually received them from various people. Again, just copies of theirs. This idea of, in the book, he calls it, you're using somebody else's poetry to convey your emotions. That seems just a very fraught topic, because people can read into, if a song has the word love in it, you're suddenly saying something you may not realize.
Yeah, I have a clip that's relevant to this.
All right.
Oh, but look, a whole new world. Kiss the girl, my cherry amour. Oh, Princeton, he does like me. I am the walrus, fat bottom girls. Yellow submarine, what does this mean?
That is a song from the puppet musical Avenue Q,
right.
In which she is having the classic experience of the guy having given her a mixtape, and she's trying to figure out what exactly it's supposed to indicate to her, and you have a sneaking suspicion that the answer may be nothing.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
But she is nevertheless laboring over, you know, as you can hear, trying to interpret whether he likes her or not.
Yeah, but I think that's inevitable. It's kind of like, I equate it to cooking, where there's all this effort that goes into the making of the thing, and there's heat loss, right? It's like emotional thermodynamics, where all this work goes through, but at the end of the formula, at the other end, they don't feel the weight of effort and time and intention.
Oh, that is not true.
It is absolutely true.
That is not true.
There is part of your lizard brain that thinks this mixtape took a day to make, this meal took 3 hours to make, therefore, somebody should be sitting here telling me how great it is for 3 hours. It's a one-on-one equation. And when that happens, it's like, as I say, emotional thermodynamics, emodynamics, call it what you will.
It depends. It depends on the individual mixtape. Mm. And because the best mixtape I ever got was from a friend of mine in law school who, after we had graduated, sent me a mixtape. I do not remember what he called it, but it was both sides, because it was a tape, because we had those then. Both sides had the same songs, but they had different versions. So it was the same progression of songs, but they were all alternate, which I thought was
lovely.
A very cool idea. And the other thing is, it wasn't totally clear that that was what it was until you listened to it. So when you listen to it, you're like, wow, this is really cool. And you get the creativity of it. Because there's two different things, right? There's the mix that's just, here's great music for you to listen to. Here's a bunch of stuff. Here's a gift of a box of music. And then there's the mix that's like the letter.
Right.
And that's the one that you're more talking about
when
you're talking about the emo dynamics.
But and the emo dynamics go both ways. There's the person who puts enormous amounts of craft into the messaging and the sequencing and worries that the person on the other end isn't getting it.
Right.
And then there's the person like the woman in Avenue Q who is trying to suss out meaning where there is none.
Right. And this is why I really skip around in your mixes and your year ends and stuff. And shuffle them and do whatever I want with them.
Do you know how hard I agonize over sequencing?
But they're not specifically for me, so they're not communicative.
Right.
They're just, here's a bunch of stuff.
It's about the agonizing over song flow, though. I made a mix once where the song, it's a cover of the Daniel Johnston song, Something's Last a Long Time, and it's by the Twilight Sad, which is like if Groundskeeper Willie were the lead singer of the world's saddest band. And so it's Something's Last a Long Time stretched into this, like, 7-minute dirge.
Something's last a long time.
The song trails off, and as it trails off, there are these tinkling little bells. And then there's a patch of kind of silence at the end of the track. And the next song I put on the mix is one of my favorite songs of all time. Talked about it on the show before, The Trapeze Swinger by Iron and Wine, which is even longer. It's like 9.5 minutes, and it's wonderful. And that song begins with the slight tinkling of the little bells. And I sent the uncompressed file of Something's Last a Long Time, which, you know, like 100-megabyte file, to Mike Katziff, so he could cut off that patch of silence so that when the song ends, it leads right into the beginning of The Trapeze Swinger, and those little tinkling bells, which are the exact same bells, tinkle from one song to the other. I sat there, I sent my mix CD, and I just waited. Just waited for that reply. Like, did you notice the bells?
See, that's it.
Did it happen?
Yeah, I was about to say, someone check Mike's Twitter feed. For Z's.
I'm just kidding.
Did you notice?
But this does get at one point, in this day and age when most of our likes and interests are often displayed for public consumption, Is there a kind of risk of the mixtape or your playlist or whatever it is also being a part of that? So instead of it being a letter, which is like you and me, this is our communication, mm-hmm. and like it goes in the box of love letters with everything mm-hmm. else or right. the box somewhere, is it a thing that I put up because I'm really more kind of showing who I am?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's the question is, do we substitute a certain amount of one-to-many sharing
yeah, right.
for
yeah.
a certain amount of one-on-one, one-to-one sharing? And I think that's a very, valid point.
Like, if you take that same ethos into your, like, so your communications with people, then I would think that it's not as satisfying, right? Like if you keep that same mentality
right.
when really it is more of a letter.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I think there's a more performative quality to making a mix where like I would feel much more comfortable with somebody listening to that mix CD, which was a personal mix CD, than I would, God knows, like having somebody read my letters. Like, I mean, part of it is that somebody else is doing the actual expressing of emotion. But, like, I would feel if somebody stumbled across that mix CD and listened to it, I wouldn't be offended the way I would if somebody read a letter.
It also obviates the need to sit in the same room with somebody with a song you really love going, huh? Wait. This is the next part. This is the next part coming up.
We did the topic once of how you introduce things to people that you... that you love, and we had this very conversation about how
worst.
You don't want to hover over them while they're listening in
the room? I always feel like when you share something with someone, you're like,
and then
do
you
this
run
now,
out.
Then you run.
Yeah, for sure. If I share a room with somebody, I don't need to give them a mix.
Well, no, I don't want to have that feeling of shame.
When I share with somebody, I'm nowhere near them.
I've betrayed some things about myself today between the hugging.
No,
and
but
the,
that's it's
we
very,
share alone.
It's very true that there is a weird way in which not only do you give people a mixtape because you're trying to say something, but you give it to them because you're trying to say something and you're so uncomfortable saying
exactly.
it that if you listen to more of that Avenue Q song, the last one she gets to is I have to say I love you in a song. So, which of course only confuses her more.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So it makes perfect sense to me that you would give the person the thing and then run away. Like that's what I would do. I would never sit there and be like, let's sit here while you process my feelings. I would never do. For the same reason that like if you give someone like a kind of a, like a love letter, very often you will like give it to the person and
just
not
run
be
for
there.
The hills.
Not be there. Well, you don't hand someone a letter and then sit there while they read it. That makes you a monster.
Well, yeah, the person reading it then has to perform also.
Well, exactly. And like the last thing that I wouldn't particularly want on either side of that equation. Like if Steven gives me something to listen to, I don't really want him to sit there while I listen to it in case like Glenn is making a comical thumbs up for those of you who are listening to this as a podcast. Anyway, again, you know, I think we'd be interested to hear what folks have to say about mixtapes. So come and tell us what you think. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, one, and this is total Zaxxon rule, but this Saturday, the day after this podcast drops, is the 10-year friendiversary of Linda Holmes and myself. 10
Aww.
Years ago, on December 20th, 2004, I wrote Linda Holmes a fan letter.
That's
and
true.
Thus began a spectacularly fruitful and ongoing friendship.
The hilarious part, though, is that he wrote me a fan letter, but if you read our early correspondence, it is entirely me trying to impress him with because that is how I am. So he started it.
I like that you don't notice that I was doing the exact
no,
same thing.
No, it is entirely me trying to
impress. Was it through song?
Before long, it was certainly, let me send you some music, what do you like? And then it was like, then he started to send me music.
And someday we will have a podcast together.
Right. That's exactly what we figured. Neither one of us worked at NPR. We were definitely like, one day we'll work at NPR and start a podcast and do live events. And no.
Yeah.
So that's total Zaxxon.
It's like a happy milestone for once.
It's true.
But that is delighting me. And also, I mean, musically, I've got to talk about the fact that there's a new D'Angelo record up that just came out. Just its very existence. I've been actually saving it for just the right moment to actually spend a bunch of time with it. But God, we just live in an age where records that people have been waiting for 15 damn years actually spring into existence. It's called Black Messiah. It's his first album in almost exactly 15 years.
You can't look me all alone, all
for me, it kind of stoked the embers of one day Dr. Dre's Detox will actually come out, and Audie is shaking her head in disgust.
I think he's a little busy right now. A little busy.
But, you know, to have, I mean, it's a little, you know, I talked about the process of year-end music, and it is incredibly irritating when, like, a major important record comes out just after you've published your year-end best of list. See also Beyonce last year. But there's a new D'Angelo record. What could be better?
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I'm going to read to you an actual synopsis of an ABC Christmas special that was on the air in 1977.
Oh, boy.
Now, dear 98% of the listening audience, I'm about to bust out some names that you've never heard before, but just take five. We'll be back in a sec. So here is the actual synopsis of a special called Paul Lynde's 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Uh-huh. I'm in that 2%, so I'm with you.
The patriarch, Clark Cosgrove, played by Paul Lynde, is frazzled by the gift demands of his loud children. I'll take a pause here. If you are familiar with a certain story about Paul Lynde on a transatlantic flight with a very loud baby, a story that I cannot repeat on NPR airwaves, that very first sentence contains a certain amount of humor, followed by his wife, Nellie, played by, think 1977.
Oh, my God.
I don't know.
Played by Anne Mira.
Uh-huh, sure.
Runs into endless friction with Clark's formidable mother, played by...
Rosemary.
Oh, good guess. Good guess. I'm going to get half points on that. Alice Ghostly. Esmeralda on Bewitched and a bunch of things.
Yeah.
Who lives with him? Nellie's inebriated father. This one's straight up the middle.
This is going to be a really long game. Paul Lynde.
No. Yeah, Paul Lynde is the patriarch. Yeah. Inebriated father. Think Hollywood Squares, 1977.
Oh, my God. Charles Nelson Reilly.
Foster Brooks, people.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is the hardest game ever.
And cat-loving mother, played by Martha Ray. Yes, of course, Martha Ray. I would have given you points for Kay Ballard.
Uh-huh.
Arrive for the holidays, and tensions arise between the mothers-in-law, a German uncle, played by...
Jerry Lewis.
Nope.
Look at
Frank Sinatra.
Nope. You're just making... You could have said R.D. Johnson. You could have said Henry Gibson. You could have said Ronnie Schell, but no, it was Howard Morris. He's also arriving, but complications ensue when a traveling salesman played by... George Gobel.
I at least know who Paul Lynde is.
George.
For so many people at
Mother
home.
Effing Gobel.
Also, 98% of us were told to chill out while you said these names, right. Which exactly. Is what I've been doing.
I'm directing my attention to the 2%. George Gobel is mistaken for the uncle, and here's the big finish. It builds. Adding to the tumult is a visit from a caroling neighbor played by...
Greg Brady.
Cher.
Edie McClurg.
These are all good guesses. Shirley They're terrible guesses. Anson... Williams. Anson Potsy Williams. Now, this is concentrated, weaponized 1977. This is a chunk of White Dwarf 1977 that is so dense that not even light can escape it. And it should be available on the internet. It is not. When I put out the word for this, I delivered this to us on Twitter, and somebody went and looked at certain means to see if it might be possible to find it. Nowhere. Now, I'm sure it is available at some museum of television
Steven's
and radio.
Steven's mother has it.
Probably does.
Taped it off on a Betamax.
Steven's mother's got it on beta.
But to find it in like an archive would require effort. So the mere existence, because I do remember this, and at the end of this... special, they do reenact 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, starring Paul Lynde in a kerchief and a cap. Awesome. So the mere existence of it makes me happy. I am sure that by putting it out to the universe, this is the secret I'm doing right now. I'm putting it out to the universe that it will be this time next year. I will not have to be pining for it because it will be on the internet because this whole internet thing is about to take off. I'm telling you.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a flash in the pan now, but if we just believe, a Christmas miracle could happen.
Wow.
And Paul Lynde's 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
We are defining miracles down.
We really are.
We really, really are.
That's what's making me happy.
But I'm happy that that is making you happy, Glenn Weldon. Audie Cornish, I don't know if you have anything quite
I don't know how to follow
fantastic
that.
Fantastic
yeah.
as that.
I mean, but. Glenn, I feel you should know from the comics that some things need to be contained from the wider population.
Yeah,
right? It's like a weapon.
It's true.
It really just...
There are some things man was not meant to watch.
It is. It's the MacGuffin of your story.
It's true.
Stephen mentioned D'Angelo's Black Messiah. But I also want to throw out there J. Cole's 2014 Forest Hills Drive and also Nicki Minaj's The Pink Print, which I have a love-hate relationship with Nicki Minaj.
I think you're supposed to.
She thinks a lot about me. No. I think I just really appreciated these artists coming out with music that's really confident and really has a lot of swagger. And with J. Cole, this is an album where you're basically watching this artist have his political awakening in real time, along with the generation that kind of brought him to us. I think it's not an accident that, you know, he's really been prominent after the Ferguson protests and things like that. If anybody wants to Google him on Letterman doing Be Free, do that, because it's amazing.
Can you tell me why? Every time I step outside, I see my people die. Oh, I'm letting you know that it ain't no gun they make that can kill my soul. Oh, no. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off, yeah. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free.
And Nicki Minaj, I think that, you know, her work induces the same joy and cringes the way that a lot of, I think, amazing rap artists who are male, the way their work does. And in a way, I kind of thought, well, that's kind of cool. You know, it's okay. Like, she doesn't have to be, I'm not looking for Lauryn Hill here. And anyway, so it's not super tearful, but they're two just great albums that came out at the end of the year. And D'Angelo, it's a third album that they hold up. You can sit through and listen to them all the way. And I think I've really missed that this year. I'm just burnt out on one-off singles and internet links.
Well, they got them in. They got them in just under the wire. All three of those things came out in December.
It's turning into like the movie business, right? Like, we're going to get all the Oscar winners at the end of the year from now on, and I should abandon hope in the summer. Get out.
Wow. Well, we would have to stop working on our year-end best lists in like October. We currently do.
Anyway, that's what's making me happy.
Fantastic. Thank you, Audie Cornish. Yeah, you know, you do not have to tell Audie Cornish that. It has been a tough couple weeks, couple months to watch news. But then I also realized this past week in particular was a week that had a lot of goodbyes in it. And this coming up week, as you're hearing this podcast, is the same. You've got the end of Craig Ferguson's show. You've got the end of Stephen Colbert's show. They went out of production on Parks and Recreation last Friday, and it was a very oddly emotional thing. There were a lot of photos, a lot of cast photos, a lot of people talking about how much they appreciated being included in that show. It's a really like big-hearted show that there's not an obvious replacement for on television, and it's being a little bit, to me, a little bit bum-rushed off of TV. They're showing two every week back to back until they run out that last 13, which kind of makes it seem like they're trying to get rid of it. And on top of all of that, you know, with the upcoming, not quite yet, but upcoming end of David Letterman's show, this is the last time Darlene Love is going to be doing her Christmas contribution to Letterman's show. I just realized that there were all these things ending, and it was very difficult. And I tried very hard to rally because, of course, you can look at Craig Ferguson's show, it's ending, but you can also say that's a guy who got to do the show he wanted to do for 9 years, and it was different, and it was special and joyful, and, you know, he had a horse dancing and all kinds of great stuff on that show. Same with Colbert. I mean, he's going to go do a new show, right? Darlene Love got to be seen by tons and tons and tons of people by doing these cool appearances with David Letterman. Parks and Rec is, for me, a miraculous piece of television. And nevertheless, today, there appeared in my life, I don't know how old it is, but there appeared a clip of a bunch of people in the London Underground singing A Little Respect by Erasure.
I'm so in love with you, I'll be forever blue. That you give me no reason why you make me wet so hard. That you give me no, that you give me no, that you give me no, that you give me no soul.
Thank you.
seemed to be a kind of spontaneous eruption of people doing a nice, cool thing together. So that is what is coming as close as possible to making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. And you can follow Audie Cornish at NPR Audie. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you
so much.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's that most wonderful time of the year, Ask Me Another's Holiday Spectacular. The show's stuffed tighter than a Christmas turkey with holiday food trivia, Christmas song parodies, and all your favorite reindeer word games. Plus, the composers of Disney's Frozen try their hand at a Mariah Carey holiday classic. You know the one. Get in the holiday spirit by listening to Ask Me Another on iTunes under Podcasts.